All right, Erev Tov to everyone. V'chol ha'mazinim. Welcome to Great Decisions, Part 24, the Raid on Baghdad, sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz. Le'ili Nishmas Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib. We discussed last time the mapach, the upheaval that brought Menachem Begin to power was precisely as advertised. Begin, true to form, was intent on transforming Israeli society. One can argue whether his pace was too quick or too slow. And he took aim at the economy, which was heavily regulated, mostly government-owned and with an oppressive bureaucracy. The socialist apparatus was sclerotic. You may remember those were the days when it could take more than a year to get a telephone from Bezek. Begin himself once said that as prime minister, he intervened for a friend to get him a phone, and he got a phone in 9 months. So it was not easy moving from a statist economy, largely government-controlled, everything was subsidized, taxes exorbitant, to a free economy where market prices would prevail, the safety net would have to be produced. So Begin's early efforts to shift the direction of the economy, to privatize and to reduce subsidies, produced hardship and financial instability, which affected his popularity. Now, inflation, which was menacing the Western world then, while Begin was in office, remember the Ford and Carter years, skyrocketed in Begin's early years, and then even more in the 80s. It was an inflation rate of maybe 400-500% in 83, 84, but without the privatization efforts that were slow to bring about, Israel's economy could not have become the powerhouse of innovation that it is today. But Begin's obsession was Jewish life, and his background, his life's experiences, the Holocaust that destroyed most of his family, Siberia, ensured that when he said "Dam Yehudi Eino Hefker," that Jewish blood is not ownerless, he meant it. Terrorist attacks drew immediate and overwhelming retaliation, and Begin launched two major excursions into Lebanon. One, Operation Litani, came in March 1978 after a dastardly terrorist attack on the coastal road killed 38 Jews. It was to clean out southern Lebanon of the PLO forces, and the overwhelming force that Israel used drew an immediate rebuke from Carter, not that Begin cared. The other excursion did not go as well. After an assassination attempt in June 1982 on Israel's ambassador to the UK, left him, Shlomo Argov, paralyzed and brain impaired. He stayed that way for the next 21 years. He died in 2003. Begin invaded Lebanon to destroy the PLO, chasing them to Beirut, but deciding first not to enter Beirut after pressure from the State Department. In the end, Arafat was and the PLO were allowed to leave to Tunisia to fight another day, but not before embroiling Israel in the Lebanese civil war that was in its eighth year then, with the mutual massacres that each side conducted. So there were no good options, only bad options, and the bad option chosen to keep a residual force in southern Lebanon to prevent the PLO from returning and to protect Israel's Lebanese Christian allies, that led Israel into the quagmire of a guerrilla war, which they were not suited to fight, and the rise of Hezbollah, and eventually Israel's hasty retreat in 2000 while Ehud Barak was prime minister, which led to Hezbollah fully seizing the control of the south, which is where we are today. Led to the flight of the Christians, led to the current instability and the incessant terror, now missile threat, that hangs over Israel's head. There's still no good options in Lebanon. The bottom line is you can't be there and you can't not be there, and that's the problem. But Begin was obsessed, and rightfully obsessed, with Israel's security, and that led inexorably to Operation Opera, the somewhat whimsically named bombing of the Iraqi nuclear reactor. Now, Iraq had first shown interest in a nuclear program in the early 1960s, and the first reactor outside Baghdad was built by the Soviets, who later provided them with enriched uranium fuel. The program, from Israel's perspective, turned ominous in the mid-1970s, after Saddam Hussein really became the power. Hussein, to be kind, was a homicidal maniac. He was part of the early revolution to overthrow the Iraqi monarchy in 1958, and then he bided his time as the Ba'ath Party elders took power. He formally deposed the president, Ahmed al-Bakr, in 1979, peacefully, ironically enough. Bakr was a fellow Tikriti, and when he did that, his power was absolute, even though he really ruled for most of the decade. The Kurdish leader, Barzani, set up Saddam Hussein. He is power-hungry to the point of insanity. And he became known already in the 70s as the Butcher of Baghdad, and he might have even enjoyed the title. He tortured for pleasure, and he murdered for sport. His prisons were torture chambers of the most brutal kind, and he slaughtered hundreds of thousands of people while in power until American troops captured him in late 2003 and the Iraqis executed him in 2006. I'm sorry to say, we shared a birthday. When he took power officially in July 1979, he'd been the strong man already for most of the decade. It was just months after the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty was signed. Egypt was largely estranged from the Arab world almost immediately, as we discussed last time, and Saddam saw golden opportunity to seize the leadership reins of the Arab people, to be the one to carry forward the fight against the accursed Zionists. No other country in the Middle East had the size, the resources, or the capability. Remember, even the Saudis, they have the size and the resources, but actually very, very small population. It's even less than Israel's population. And Saddam realized in the mid-70s, strangely, just like Sadat came to the same conclusion, that the Arabs were no longer in a position to defeat Israel with conventional weapons, and that led him to seek, for the first, not for the last time, a weapon of mass destruction that would solve the Jewish problem relatively quickly. Nonetheless, as we'll discuss, his hatred of Israel did not stop him from launching an incredibly self-destructive war against Iran in 1980, which plays a role here too, a war that Iraq began to lose in 1982, but did not end until 1988, with more than a million casualties on both sides. And Egypt, which post-Sadat supported Iraq militarily in the war with Iran, once again became an Iraqi ally. So around this time, there was a rapprochement between those two countries. Already in 1976, Iraq had purchased a light water nuclear reactor from France, $300 million deal, exchange for oil and money. The French named the reactor Osirak, after Osiris, the Egyptian god, and they added Iraq in the end. The Iraqis called it Tammuz, after the ancient Babylonian month in which the Ba'ath Party had come to power in 1968. Tammuz was an ancient Avodah Zarah in Bavel. We, in fact, brought our month's names with us back from Bavel. And if you're wondering why that month is named for an idol, the Babylonian god of fertility, it's been much discussed among the poskim. How is that we name our month after Sivan, before of Tammuz, after a Babylonian god? The Malbim says that Tammuz means hot in Aramaic, one of the synonyms for hot, and therefore it's appropriate for the summertime. The Iraqis call the plan Tammuz 17. Shivasar b'Tammuz. How's that for irony after the date they came to power, the 17th day of the Babylonian month of Tammuz? Both Iraq and France insisted that the reactor was for peaceful purposes, to produce low-cost energy, just like Iran says today, along with its threats to eradicate Israel, just like Iraq did. French President Giscard and his Prime Minister Jacques Chirac would later scramble for cover, blaming each other for allowing it to get to that stage. But already in 1975, France knew that the reactor it was selling had far greater capacity than Iraq needed for peaceful purposes. In any event, Iraq had some of the largest oil reserves in the world, still does. They didn't really need nuclear energy. The bottom line is that France wanted Iraqi oil, at the end of 1975 already, which is 6 years before the attack, the Hudson Institute reported that the Iraqi program, as it stood then, would allow the Iraqis within several years to produce enough plutonium for 2 atomic bombs annually. In July 1980, Iraq received its first shipment from France of highly enriched uranium fuel for the reactor. If you follow current events, you know Iran is enriching its own uranium. That's what's taken time. But Iraq went out and bought their enriched uranium. For sure, Hussein had genocidal ambitions against Israel, and he wasn't shy talking about it. He spoke about it openly, just like Iran does today. And it was known that he aimed to achieve dominance in the Arab world, in the Middle East. And as we later realized, he saw himself as another Nebuchadnezzar. The question was, what could Israel do about it? We now know that Israel's concerns about the Iraqi reactor predated Menachem Begin, dated back to Rabin's tenure in office. Begin inherited the problem. So the Israelis first applied pressure on France, diplomatic pressure, to no avail. When Begin was informed shortly after he took office that France had decided to provide Iraq with tested fuel, meaning weapons-grade fuel from its own arsenal, then he stepped up Israel's countermeasures, all shrouded in secrecy and deniability. The first time the government met in earnest about this question was in August 1978, just a week or two before Begin left for Camp David. It was a protracted discussion that took place in the cabinet about the Iraqi bomb and about the feasible options to deal with the Iraqi bomb, and the sides began forming almost immediately. The Minister of Agriculture, Ariel Sharon at the time, strongly supported military action, and he argued that Israel should publicly state that the development of a nuclear capability by any enemy of Israel would be perceived as an act of war, which in fact is Israel's policy now for 30 years already. In that he was supported, he says to his surprise, by the mild-mannered minister Simcha Ehrlich, but military action was also vehemently opposed by the defense minister, Ezer Weitzman, by Yigael Yadin, who's the deputy prime minister, by Yosef Burg, who's the head of the Mafdal, by Yitzhak Chofi, who's the head of the Mossad, by Shlomo Gazit, who was the head of IDF intelligence, later by the opposition leader, Shimon Peres, and few would change their minds during the ensuing 3 years. So right then, in the late summer of 1978, to preserve Israel's options, Begin tasked the chief of staff, Raful Eitan, with creating a military option, military response. In the short term, other measures were taken that strike to us a familiar ring. On April 6, 1979, at the French port of Toulon, 2 core reactors about to be shipped to Iraq mysteriously blew up. These things happen. The Mossad was blamed. On June 6, 1980, an Egyptian nuclear scientist who was working on the project, Yahya El-Mishad, was on Iraq's Atomic Energy Commission, was found dead in his Paris hotel room with multiple stab wounds. Again, the Mossad was suspected, but nothing was proven. If that doesn't ring a bell, it should. Now, there were clandestine contacts between Israel and the Iranians in 1980 about Iran bombing the reactor, which, after all, would affect them probably more immediately than it would affect Israel. Remember, of course, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and Iran and Israel both shared then a common enemy, Iraq. But Iran refused to help Israel. Remember, the Ayatollah was already in power, but the truth is, even when the Shah was in power, there were no diplomatic relations between Israel and the Iranians, only covert contact. But in fact, Iran did bomb the site, at least they attacked the site, the El Tawaitha plant, at 17 miles southwest of Baghdad. Iran bombed it in the early stages of the war, September 30th, 1980, but fearing that the reactor was already radioactive, Iran just bombed the control room and the surrounding areas, but not the reactor itself. So in short order, Iraq would be able to turn it around. In any event, the work was slowed, but not disrupted or permanently halted. And Iraq then began negotiating furiously with a multitude of countries for enriched uranium, with France, with Italy, with Niger, and even with Portugal, and all countries are looking to make deals with the Iranians. And it was then in 1978-79, already the American government was brought into the picture. Jimmy Carter was a big opponent of nuclear proliferation. You remember his daughter Amy was as well, but did nothing about it. The Americans simply were unwilling to act. There was no present danger. And besides, Iran was the enemy of America, not yet Iraq. Don Rumsfeld, remember that famous picture, even visited Saddam in 1983. So in this instance, Israel and the U.S. were on different sides. Israel saw Iraq as the greater menace. After all, Iraq threatened them, not Iran, while the U.S. saw Iran as the greater menace because Iraq had already attacked American interests, not to mention seized diplomats as hostages. The Israeli government had to weigh other factors as well. When could they ascertain when the reactor was fueled, meaning there'd be radioactive fallout if bombed? What would be the international reaction if Israel bombed? For sure, as an act of war, even if Israel claimed it was self-defense. And would Saddam Hussein really launch a nuclear missile at Israel? It's hard to believe that a human being can sink to such a level. And not the least of it, was a military operation even doable? Could Israel fly that distance? It's more than 600 miles from the airbase to the reactor site south of Baghdad. It's like flying from here to Charleston, South Carolina, and then back. It's over 1,200 miles round trip, all through enemy territory, somehow to evade the radar and the air defenses of three hostile Arab countries, reach, neutralize the target, and return safely. It sounds fanciful, like things you'd see in a movie. None of that was taken for granted, and apparently three Israeli Air Force pilots were killed during training maneuvers for the mission. The most dangerous aspect was not the end, was flying just 200 feet above the sand. Remember, they had to fly the same way over the Red Sea to Entebbe, but flying over the sand very low is very dangerous in its own right. One question was answered for Begin by the Mossad. It gave a report that stated that Hussein was capable of using a nuclear weapon against Israel. A psychological profile given to Begin in the spring of 1980 reported that Hussein was rational and hard-hearted, if cruel, but, I quote, when he sees a chance to fulfill his megalomaniac ambitions for personal greatness, he is ready to take risks and drastic action without weighing all the risks he is actually running in the situation. This assessment, by the way, was on target, as we saw in 1991 and 2003, when Hussein essentially invited an American attack, a United States with military capabilities that dwarfed his own, and yet he still invaded Kuwait, he still refused to withdraw, later refused to allow full inspection of his WMD programs. He invited two invasions, the second of which forced him to meet his end. But it was that report, that psychological profile of Begin that was on his desk when he ordered the attack eventually. And Begin would say 2 days after the raid, I quote, Saddam Hussein, the ruler of Iraq, who with his own hands killed his best friends in order to be the sole ruler of that country, had an ambition. He wanted to develop nuclear weapons so that he could either try to bring Israel to its knees on behalf of the Arab world or to destroy her menfolk. He didn't mention the womenfolk. Her menfolk and infrastructure and the great part of her army, which consists of reservists in the cities. In other words, he wanted to destroy our existence, in fact, our people and our country. There was another factor that came to play here. That was the domestic situation. Israel had an election scheduled for June 30th, 1981, in the spring, mainly because of the economy. Likud was trailing significantly in the polls. Shimon Peres, who opposed the attack, would later call it, I quote, an election stunt, which really was an insult to Begin, who took it as such, outraged that he'd be suspected of risking Jewish lives, that of the pilots, to what he said was to death, or to a fate worse than death, capture, all for electoral purposes. Now, in fact, there was an electoral stunt that the Likud pulled off in the spring of 1981. Yoram Aridor became the finance minister during the campaign, and right away he slashed taxes on cars, on appliances, the VAT, in effect, giveaways to the people that in fact worked. He also reintroduced color TV into Israel, and that also numbed the people. In December 1979, Raful Eitan, together with the head of the Air Force, the debonair David Ivry, presented a plan to Weizmann and Begin. It involved the use of multiple aircraft that would fly through Jordanian and Saudi airspace, evading radar with bombers and support aircraft. But the distance was so enormous that refueling would be required at a certain point. And remember, for the Entebbe raid, they were able to refuel in Kenya. But here there were no friendly Arab countries. They have to refuel in midair over one of those Arab countries. And also, Israel's main aircraft at the time was the Phantom F-4. And the mission itself would stretch its range. And it was dangerous. Planes would be flying at top speed, about 550, 600 miles per hour, about 100 to 200 feet off the ground, all to avoid radar detection. A hill, a slight mound, could crash the plane. A slight distraction could be catastrophic. In a cruel irony, I mentioned one of the three pilots killed during training for the mission was the son of Raful Eitan. And he, in fact, ended his shiva early in May in order to partake again of the planning. And the secrecy was absolute. It's really amazing in retrospect. At the time, already 1981, Yitzhak Shamir was now the foreign minister. And he would nonchalantly question his son Yair Shamir. Yair was an IAF pilot. Then he was the head of training. Today he's the minister of agriculture, part of Yisrael Beiteinu. So Shamir would ask his son nonchalantly about the long-range capabilities of Israel's aircraft without revealing to him why he was asking. By the same token, unbeknownst to Yitzhak Shamir, Yair, as head of training, was intimately involved in planning the mission, and neither mentioned it to each other until many years later. Even Begin never informed his wife of the situation or the planning until after the mission. A sense of urgency began to develop late 80, early 81, because of reports and because of the great unknown, which is always a factor even today. Already March 1980, a London newspaper and the New York Times both reported that Iraq would have a bomb within a year. And Iraq, like Iran today, was relentless in its propaganda against Israel and its threat to destroy the Zionist entity, with Iraq now filling the void in the Arab world left by the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty. In April 1981, April 1980, with the plan approved, long-range flight practices going on, mid-air refueling being practiced, it all began. That same week, interestingly and tragically, there was a terrorist attack at Misgav Am, a kibbutz near Kiryat Shmona. Three Jews were murdered, including a two-year-old, and the attack was carried out by the Arab Liberation Front, which was an Iraqi group. So Sharon suggested using that attack as a pretext to destroy the reactor within a week or two. But it's ironic how these things happen. Later that same month, it was April 1980. What happened? That was when Jimmy Carter ordered the rescue of the American hostages in Iran, and the mission failed miserably. Two helicopters crashed. It's a failure emblematic of the Carter years, and the mission was aborted. When that happened, David Ivry later said, "Until then, we never considered the possibility of technical failure. With the botched American mission, the Israelis felt they had to practice and plan even more, so the bombing of the reactor was placed on hold." But not the work of the reactor. In June 1980, Tammuz 2, that two reactors, Tammuz 2 was the smaller one, became operational. Iraq looked to import uranium, as I mentioned. Over the summer, France was pressured not to sell to Iraq, but they brushed off American concerns and they pointed to the Americans selling 38 kilograms of uranium that same summer to India as a counterweight to the Pakistani bomb. So that went nowhere, and Iraq got its uranium within weeks. There's several other developments that played a key role. The first shipment of F-16s, which had a greater range than the F-4s, arrived in Israel in early July. It was lighter, it had greater range, it would greatly facilitate the mission, much more than the Phantoms. A half year later, the plans were finalized when more shipments of F-16s arrived, and Israel now had two full squadrons. A change in the cabinet also helped Begin. Moshe Dayan, who quietly favored action, resigned as foreign minister in October 1979, replaced by the more hawkish Yitzhak Shamir. And in May 1980, Ezer Weizmann resigned as defense minister. Both were unsatisfied with the pace of the autonomy negotiations. And who replaced Weizmann as defense minister? Begin himself. He became the acting defense minister, which was really traditional in Israeli politics until the Six-Day War. Sharon would not be appointed to defense until after the next election. So the cabinet lineup was more favorably disposed to attacking. And Yuval Ne'eman began to play a role. Ne'eman became an influential advisor. Later he was a minister in the government, big right-winger, head of TRIA. He was then the head of Israel's Atomic Energy Commission, a genius nuclear physicist and outspoken supporter of eradicating the Iraqi nuclear capabilities. So he warned Begin in the summer of 1980 that with their current supply of uranium, Iraq will be able to produce one bomb, or they could take a longer process, convert the uranium to plutonium, and eventually make several bombs a year. He gave them a maximum of 2 years, meaning 1982. And Shamir got to work as a foreign minister trying to convince the French and the Italians to desist from providing uranium and other material to the Iraqis. Shamir was rebuffed at every opportunity. Talk of an impending attack first surfaced in July 1980, but there was another development that added a new wrinkle, and that's September 17th, 1980. Iraq invaded Iran, which it assumed was weak and vulnerable, and a brutal, bloody war that would last 8 years began. Now think about it. One reason why it turned out, in retrospect, the Iraqi defenses were so weak, the reactor was so vulnerable, was because so much of their materiel was in the north fighting Iran. Within 2 weeks, Iran bombed the vicinity of the reactor, damaging related areas. Iraq nonetheless blamed Israel for it. But for the moment, the reactors went cold. But Pentagon intelligence still reported in the fall that Iraq should have a weapon within 1 year. With that, the mini cabinet met to discuss Israel's options. Now we're in the fall of 1980, and Begin presided over a robust debate. He said, started by talking, and even though he usually let others talk first, this time he spoke first, he said Israel is a choice of two evils before it. One evil is striking Iraq, which was otherwise weakened and preoccupied with war, or allowing Iraq to eventually have a nuclear capability that would threaten Israel's very existence. There are many reasons to oppose the forcible destruction of the Iraqi reactor, and they're all raised by the ministers. Some feared that would induce the superpowers to preemptively strike the nuclear programs of other nations, meaning Israel. Some fear that the Soviets might attack Israel. Some fear that relations with the U.S. would be impaired, if not completely wrecked. Some fear the mission might fail. They all fear that. The pilots might be captured and tortured. At the time, they said it was 1980 now. You hear the same refrain today. There was no urgency. There's no bomb yet. There's still time for diplomacy to work and for some other nation to do the job. And of course, that's always the problem. You never know until it's too late. By definition, until there's a bomb, there is no bomb. So until there's a bomb, there's no time. Once there is a bomb, you're out of time. There's no intermediate stage. Some fear that would vitiate the treaty with Egypt, which was true but misleading. Iraq and Egypt were enemies longtime adversaries even before this, and weakening Iraq would strengthen Egypt. Sadat actually thought Saddam was insane. And you had that old standby that if Israel bombed the Iraqi reactor, that would unite the Arab world against Israel, as if they weren't already, and as if peace was just around the corner. One of the main opponents, Yigael Yadin, said that Israel benefits from the fragmentation of the Arab world, and this would cause all of them to coalesce against Israel. He also threatened to resign if a strike was approved. Yosef Borg was also opposed. We forget the old Maftal was very dovish. That's why they made such natural partners with the Labor Party. And all the opponents suggested that at most, destroying the reactor would delay the Iraqi bomb for a few years, not stop it permanently. So what would Israel gain, even if successful, certainly when compared to the risks? And others argued that the reactors were then not operational because of the war, so why bomb them? To which the counter-argument was that now, therefore, would be a perfect time to bomb them because they're not operational and fewer people would get hurt. All these were powerful counterforces to Begin's position, which was informed by one dominant event, the Holocaust. Begin vowed to never allow the existence of a weapon of mass destruction that would endanger the lives of Jewish women and children, and never to allow Israel's defense to be delegated to other countries. Bitter experience, personal experience, had taught him that promises and guarantees were unreliable. And Begin said that Jews are not at liberty to sit with their arms folded and wait for their extermination. No nation could live, could prosper, he said, with a sword of Damocles hanging over its head. Add to the cabinet, the intelligence services were dead set against the strike. Chofi of Mossad, and now Yoshua Sagi, who was head of Amman military intelligence. The matter was to be referred to the full cabinet, but the mini cabinet voted 5-4 to approve the attack. It was Begin, Shamir Sharon, Simcha Ehrlich, and Yigal Horowitz vote in favor, and Yadin, Yosef Borg, Zvulun Hammer, the other minister from the Maftal, Eliezer Shostak voted against. It was a razor-thin margin, 5-4. Any action, though they agreed, would be postponed until after the American elections, Carter versus Reagan. Then, in November, Iraq banned inspections of the International Atomic Energy Commission, another ominous sign. Now, after Carter lost, Begin visited him in the White House, November 1980. Carter said he would brief Reagan on this issue, but he never did. Even the transition file that each department prepares for its successor ignored the Iraqi bomb. So we'll see when it happened. Reagan was completely shocked. He had no idea why, out of the blue, Israel bombed the reactor. And keep in mind that Reagan was also out of commission for 2 months before the bombing. Just 2 months after he took office, he was recovering from an assassination attempt. When the new American Secretary of State, Alexander Haig, met Begin in the spring, Haig informed him that all American attempts at intervention were in vain. Words that Begin interpreted as the end of any diplomatic solution. Another date was set for April 1981 and postponed again when the Syrians attacked Israel's Maronite allies in Lebanon. Begin held they'd be unable to help the Christians in the wake of the bombing, but by late April, everything was in place. The plan, which planes, how many planes, what type of ordnance to use, what targets to hit. Only thing left was the decision to go forward, and then the attack itself. Well, the final decision was left in the hands of three people. That was the cabinet vote in December already. We wanted to deal with it publicly. Begin, Shamir, and Eitan would decide when to attack. For Begin, it was sheer agony. Remember, he had suffered two heart attacks in the previous 3 years. So it weighed heavily on him. He worried first about the pilots. He worried about the consequences of success and the consequences of failure. And then he had to deal with something else in April 1981. Sad to say, leaks. With a date set for May 10th, opponents, especially a very bitter Ezer Weitzman, began contacting anyone in government they knew to try to force Begin's hand. Weitzman, who apparently was tipped off by Yitzhak Chofi of Mossad, approached people in public, called them at home, even solicited ministers at the funeral for Eitan's son, Yoram. And he had several variations on one question. He could be very blunt. He'd go from person to person saying, "Are you all out of your minds?" It's a question too. Yadin refused to talk to him on the phone. Borg rebuffed him, saying he voted against it, so don't talk to him. Shimon Peres sent a letter begging Begin to stop, a letter that at least was circumspect in its language. He didn't mention the operation. Rabin, who was fully briefed for months, was completely opposed. Reporters were informed about it, but it was a different era. They kept it discreet, and the pressure was intense, and the raid was called off for the following reason. Begin figured if so many people now knew the date, the Iraqis might know it as well, so they can't do it. And there was another factor that was coming and played a significant role, and that was the election scheduled for June 30th. So Begin resented the implication that he would do it to win votes, but in fact, the impending election played a significant role. Likud was trailing in the polls, although not as much already in May, but Begin and Sharon realized that if Peres won, he would never attack. So the raid was timed not so much to help the Likud in the election, but because Begin feared losing, and Peres' weakness and caution and love of the French would inhibit him from ever doing anything. In the meantime, Begin was sitting on reports that the reactor would be hot, radioactive, by mid-July or the latest mid-September. Reports came in the spring that Iraq had built large earthen ramparts around the facility to protect it from attack. The raid was scheduled again for the beginning of June, postponed again for a week, so as not to interfere with Begin's summit with Sadat, scheduled for June 4th. D-Day was finally set for June 7th, Sunday, June 7th, Erev Shavuos. They figured a Sunday evening would be best because there was a time when foreign workers would be least likely to be there. The pilots were put on notice on Shabbos. Raphael Eitan briefed them at the airbase. Etzion Airbase was in Sinai at the time. Eitan briefed them, and in the traditional macabre humor of the military, he handed out dates, a bag of dates, to every pilot, dates being a classic Iraqi snack, saying with a smile, "You might as well get used to eating Iraqi food in case some of you fall into captivity." Ha ha. It was called Mivtza Opera, some called it Mivtza Bavel, Operation Babylon, and so it went. A total of 8 F-16s led the raid, escorted by 6 F-15s. The F-15s would fight off any other jets that came to encounter them. Some names became famous. Zev Raz commanded. Yiftach Spector, famous ace, participated. The junior pilot, the one who flew the 8th of the F-16s, was a young Ilan Ramon. So he was to be the last bomber, the most at risk. If Iraqi defenses responded, he was chosen because at the time he was unmarried, the only one who was unmarried, and thus if caught, he would not leave his wife in Aguna. Raz later said they just assumed that not everyone would return alive. They flew from the Etzion Air Base in Sinai across the Gulf of Eilat, heading for Saudi Arabia. They left at 3:55 p.m., 5 to 4, Sunday afternoon, and you know the unpredictable always happens. They flew over the Gulf at a height of 700 meters. Remember, they have a formation of 14 aircraft flying. Who do they fly over but the yacht of a sunbathing King Hussein, who looked up, Hussein of Jordan, and saw these Israeli planes flying overhead, heading towards his airspace and Saudi airspace. Accounts differ as to what he did. Some say he did nothing. Others say that he notified the Iraqis, who ignored him. Saddam Hussein was actually in the north of Iraq on the battlefield. Or that he called the Saudi king, King Khalid, who was at the time being medically treated in Switzerland. You cannot be a king of Saudi Arabia unless you're old and sickly. What he did, we'll never know. But when they arrived in Saudi airspace, they dropped to 200 feet. In his office, Begin received word at 4 o'clock they'd taken off. He said, Hashem yirachem aleihem. Those are his words. And he spent the next minutes, maybe an hour, circling, pacing his office, reciting Tehillim by heart. Erev Shavuos, the afternoon, he had the entire cabinet called. They did not know what was taking place. Called one by one. Each asked individually, come to see him in his office at 5 o'clock for private meeting. Each thought they were being called individually. They did not know what was happening. When they entered Iraq, some of the F-15 split off to combat Iraqi fighter jets, which never appeared. And as the F-16s climbed to 10,000 feet, they sighted the dome of the reactor and let loose. They were pleasantly surprised by the lack of resistance, either fighters or anti-aircraft missiles at first. Raz said the radar had to have spotted them 10 to 15 minutes at least before the attack, but nothing happened. At 5:30 p.m., just 90 minutes after they launched, they saw the dome beneath them. Raz was in the first plane. He dove at the target. He released his bombs at 3,500 feet. It destroyed the dome, left the reactor exposed. A perfect hit. You have to understand that the Americans in the early part of the Iraqi war, I'm sorry, in the early part of the Gulf War, went to bomb the same reactor again. They had multiple sorties, dropping hundreds of bombs over the course of 2-3 days. Here, again, the execution was flawless, almost miraculous. Raz dropped his bombs and flew up. Other bombs followed, depositing their loads at 5-second intervals. The structure was a cloud of smoke. Tammuz 1 was destroyed, along with the structures in the immediate vicinity. Tammuz 2 was not hit, but it was smaller, it was posed no military threat, it was not the target. All but two bombs hit their targets. Freed of their bombs, the lighter F-16 surged upward, disappeared. Iraqi anti-aircraft fire came late and was futile. Their defenses were trained to respond within 2 or 3 minutes. The Israelis came and went in 80 seconds, a minute 20. As they flew west into the sun, the pilots radioed each other, Shemesh Bigivon Dome. V'yarech b'emek ayalon. Let the sun stay away, because they couldn't see where they were going. The head of Iraqi air defenses and all Air Force personnel above the rank of major were summarily executed by Saddam Hussein. He was out of town that day. The Israelis on the way back refueled over Jordan, flying at normal altitude, were not confronted by any Jordanian aircraft. Again, they flew over King Hussein's yacht on the way back to Sinai. They left before 4 p.m. Erev Shavuos. They were back at 6:45 p.m. in time for Yom Tov. At 5:35, Begin received a phone call from Eitan that the reactor had been destroyed. All planes were returning home. He said, Baruch Hashem. Some laughed with joy. Some of the ministers there. Some cried with joy. The cabinet debated briefly whether to issue a statement. They did not know what Iraq would do. You think back a few years, allegedly Israelis destroyed the reactor in Syria. Syria said nothing about it. Neither has Israel formally. It was a lively debate. Begin thought Israel should not act like thieves in the night, as if they did something wrong. Borg said, if no one else says anything, why should Israel? We should wait to see if someone says something. And then he left for shul. He said he's giving a shiur in a shul in Yerushalayim. He can't stay anymore. And that was that. Nothing was said publicly until Israel radio reported the next day. Shavuos. Raz was shocked to hear it on Kol Yisrael. Shocked to hear them announce the raid. He hadn't even told his family where he'd been. He was back home for Yom Tov. On Isruchag, the cabinet sat in awe as they watched the film of the raid already set to music. You could watch the film, by the way. It's going to play it, but our technology is a little out now. Late Sunday afternoon, Sunday evening, Begin called Sam Lewis, the American ambassador to Israel, told him to inform President Reagan. Lewis was shocked, and he was silent till he composed himself. Then he called Reagan, who was also shocked. Begin called the Labor Party leaders. Rabin said, Kol HaKavod. Peres was much less enthusiastic. And to Begin's surprise, Peres denounced it the next day as an election stunt, violating for the first, but not the last time, what had been an unwritten rule of Israeli politics. When lives are at stake, everyone bands together. But you know why that was a rule of Israeli politics? It was a rule when Begin was in opposition. Begin supported the Sinai campaign in 56. He joined the government in 67. He didn't criticize the government at all while the Yom Kippur War was raging. And he certainly never criticized the government when he was overseas. That ended now. It ended right here. And Israeli foreign and security policy has been extremely partisan for the last 30 years. Even the Laborite Chaim Herzog did not distinguish himself criticizing the raid on American television as unnecessary. One French technician was killed in the raid. Israel later paid restitution to his family. There were 10 Iraqi casualties. No compensation was offered to them. Now, what was the reaction? Well, Peres probably hurt himself by politicizing the raid. In the elections 3 weeks later, Likud defeated Labor by a scant 10,000 votes, razor thin 48 to 47 seats in the Knesset. The Mafdal lost 6 seats and their decline began. They've been resurrected the last election, but their decline began, ironically predicted by Borg. He said if the Likud is seen as a traditional party, at least protecting religious interests, then the Mafdal would lose its base, and that happened. Likud gained 5 seats, formed a coalition with the NRP, the Mafdal, with Aguda, with Tami. Tami was a Mafdal breakaway that was led by Aaron Abu Chatzero, who eventually go to prison, but whose ethnic party was an inspiration for Shas. So Begin did win the election. Begin predicted immediately and correctly, I quote, he said Sadat would not sit Shiva over the Iraqi reactor, and he was correct. The peace treaty survived. The American reaction was more incensed. Bear in mind that the State Department bureaucrats were largely Arabists, usually anti-Israel, and they saw Israel now as destabilizing Iraq, whom the Americans favored over Iran. Reagan, in fact, was pretty mild about the whole thing. He recorded news of it in his diary. He wrote, I swear, I believe Armageddon is near. Then he wrote, Begin informed us after the fact that he was afraid the reactor would go hot and radiation would be loosed on Baghdad. June 9th, Reagan writes, you can read all this today, I can understand his fear, but feel he took the wrong option. He should have told us in the French, and we could have done something to remove the threat. Notice, he hadn't yet even been told what the State Department knew. He continues, however, we are not turning on Israel. That would be an invitation to the Arabs to attack. Now, in this, Reagan echoes, who really was Israel's patron in this entire event, and that's Alexander Haig, Zachur Latov, one of the few in the inner circle who urged an expression of disapproval of sorts, but nothing more. Others, Vice President George Bush, Caspar Weinberger, wanted a very sharp reprimand, cancellation of all aid, etc. They failed, but it was in this hostile climate that the administration proposed to sell the AWACS to Saudi Arabia, and they succeeded over Israel's objections. Next day, State announced that it would have Congress investigate whether Israel violated American law by using American planes for offensive, not defensive, purposes. But Reagan wrote in his diary, frankly, if Congress should decide to do that, I'll grant a presidential waiver. Iraq is still technically at war with Israel, and I believe they were preparing to build an atom bomb. So Reagan was, in fact, genuinely surprised to learn within days that Carter had failed to brief him on this matter, and that tempered his response. The American response was, in the end, more to save face with the Arabs than to punish Israel. In the end, that investigation featured an Israeli letter to Congress that spelled out Israel's claim of self-defense, and it was accepted in essence. On June 11th, 5 Arab ambassadors visited Reagan to complain. Reagan recorded in his diary, their indignation on behalf of Iraq is a waste. Saddam Hussein is a no-good nut, End quote. But officially, the reaction was much more hostile. The U.S. joined two U.N. Security Council resolutions condemning Israel, one call on Israel to refrain from such attacks in the future, all right? But the U.S. barred any U.N. punitive action, even derailed an attempt to expel Israel from the IAEA. And Begin said, after the Security Council voted, better a condemnation with no reactor than a reactor with no condemnation. The U.S. did temporarily halt the shipment of four more F-16s to Israel, but that was reinstated 2 months later. When Begin visited Reagan for the first time in September, they didn't always get along. Begin said, I quote, it was the warmest reception he'd ever received from an American president. Of course, he only had Carter by comparison. And the American intelligence agencies bombarded Congress with material that showed that Iraq's nuclear program was not a threat. In fact, they were wrong. Interesting, by the way, that October, Reagan met Paris in the White House and recorded in his diary, surprisingly, he wants us to continue befriending the Arabs. Go figure. The New York Times blasted Israel, I quote, for an act of inexcusable and short-sighted aggression. The LA Times said Begin was as much a terrorist as Arafat. Congress wasn't as supportive of Israel then as it is now, but Ted Kennedy became a major voice defending Israel. Sadat was belligerent in public, but not in private. He met Nixon. Nixon records, he said to Sadat, Begin is irrational and irresponsible. Sadat, yes, he is crazy. Crazy like a fox. On June 9th, Begin spoke at a press conference. It was Isruchag, and he was defiant. He refused to apologize. He reiterated that Israel's cause is just. He said that 1.5 million Jewish children were poisoned by gas during the Holocaust. I mean, he said it makes no difference whether it's Zyklon B or radioactivity. He would not allow Jewish children to be murdered by radioactivity. Never again, never again. Tell your friends, tell anyone you meet, we shall defend our people with all the means at our disposal. There was some voice of support for Israel, especially in Congress. I'll tell you a story. 1989, I found myself at the Pentagon at a briefing, and the new Secretary of Defense was Dick Cheney, who said that Israel must refrain from, I quote, any unilateral actions, like the raid on Baghdad. They should first coordinate with the U.S. So I asked him, I seem to recall that one of those voices that supported Israel openly in 1981 was a freshman congressman from Wyoming, then named Richard Cheney. Do you remember that? So Cheney, you know how he looked, he still looks, he cocked his head, had a half smile, talking on the side of his mouth, and he said, well, I have a different job now. And that was his answer. In that different job, 2 years later, after the Americans invaded Iraq, Cheney sent David Ivry a satellite picture of the Osirak reactor site, thanking him, I quote, the outstanding job he did on the Iraqi nuclear program in 1981, which made our job much easier in Desert Storm. And so it goes. Over the years, the inconsistent voice is still saying nothing was really accomplished, that it just set back Iraq a few years. It forced Saddam's program underground, as later did Iran's. They were not close to a weapon, etc. But the consensus among sane people today is that Israel did something for which it was criticized at the time, but that greatly benefited civilization in the long term. Eizeu chacham haroes hanolad. You have to foresee consequences. It arguably was Begin's crowning achievement as prime minister. And in fact, for all the bluster and all his attempts, Saddam Hussein never did acquire a nuclear weapon. Interestingly, Saddam never responded to the attack, except apparently in one context. Many maintain that when he launched the Scuds at Israel, 39 Scuds in 1991 during the Gulf War, there was partial retaliation for this, as well as an attempt to lure Israel into the war. Israel did not retaliate, as we well know. but in fact they tried to. It's very interesting. We now know in 1992, Israel planned what they called Mivtza Siach Atad, Operation Bramble Bush, I don't know who makes up these names, in which the plan was Israeli commandos would fire a rocket at Saddam's vehicle. Now the plan was as follows. They knew Saddam had an uncle who was terminally ill. He was soon to die. His funeral would be in Tikrit, in Hussein's hometown. And at the funeral, they would infiltrate, shoot a rocket at his Jeep, and be done with him. On November 5th, 1992, preparations went horribly awry when during a drill, a practice drill for this operation, a live rocket was mistakenly fired at a Jeep, killing five members of Sayeret Matkal. This was the infamous Asan Tse'elim, the Tse'elim accident, which was witnessed, you recall now, it's all hazy, was witnessed by Ehud Barak, who was then the chief of staff, who quickly left the scene to avoid compromising the planning, such that when he ran for election, his opponents ran advertisements that said, Ehud Barak, meaning he fled. He had people injured, and he fled the scene. In retrospect now, it's understandable why he left the scene, so as not to elicit too many questions as to why he was there. But in fact, because of the accident, the operation was abandoned, and Saddam Hussein eventually found American justice. So finally, what does this all say about the Iranian bomb? The reactions and the responses have been identical. The supplying countries, European and Asian, claiming it's all peaceful, not military. These same countries entering into lucrative contracts with Iran for oil and other trade. The genocidal rhetoric emanating from Iran about Israel. The broken agreements, the dodging of the inspectors. The unexplained deaths of scientists and work accidents that delay the project. The claim by some strategists that an Iranian bomb is a good idea. It'll stabilize the Middle East by weakening Israel. Also the same is the fecklessness of the West, probably more with Iran than even with Iraq. And also the same, as I speak, is the opposition of Israel's intelligence establishment to military action, which is a big inhibition now. Certainly the military option is here much more difficult. There are multiple facilities in Iran, not just one. Some are underground, cannot be destroyed with ordinary weapons. You know, like I said about Entebbe, some operations are one-timers. You can't duplicate them because the targets now know what can happen. Israel's still been denied, or they're still seeking bunker-busting bombs. The Americans have not yet been granted. I was told a few months ago by a reliable authority, someone in a position to know, that Israel has a military option and the capability to execute it, and they almost did at one point in 2012 after Obama won re-election. More can't be said, but in fact, who really knows? Ultimately, with all the cabinet deliberations and all the votes, the decision to strike Iraq was made by one person, Menachem Begin, who had very unique and tragic life experiences that simply do not inform the Israeli leadership today. Maybe only a survivor can look at a genocidal enemy, a Haman, in the eye and really believe that their threats are sincere, or at least that he will not wait to find out. The question is Netanyahu like Begin? Does the military option really exist? Will the West or some Israelis convince themselves that an Iranian bomb will be less destabilizing than attacking it? If they get a bomb, then soon after, we know the Saudis, they've already contracted with the Pakistanis, the Egyptians, the Turks will soon follow, and the Middle East will be even more of a tinderbox. In the end, the raid on Baghdad, Israel weathered all the criticism. The dire predictions of Shimon Peres and others did not come to pass. Would the same thing happen here? A lot of screaming for weeks and then nothing. That is one question that Israel ponders. As it ponders it, Ashaon mitaktek, the clock ticks. They dealt with all these questions once before, and Menachem Begin, in one of his finest hours, gained 3 decades of stability for his country and reasserted an even more basic principle, that Jews would defend themselves, that Jews would not rely on the kindness of others, and that Dam Yehudi eino hefker. That principle needs public and pronounced reinforcement every now and then. And so it was, miraculously so, on June 7th, 1981. I thank you all very much.